Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Robert Smith, NPR's New York correspondent in New York City, filling in for Ken Rudin.
And Robert, if anyone could fill in for Ken Rudin, I would say it would be you.
Well, you know, I suspected that something was wrong because I've been sending Ken jokes about New York politics all week long, and I haven't gotten anything back from him.
Ken has been a little under the weather, and you know he is really sick. If he's not here to talk about his beloved New York and its politics today.
When politics, scandal, and the New York Yankees come together, you know it's all about Ken Rudin.
So let's start then at the top. Robert, the chief executive of the state of New York, as we speak here on Thursday, is still David Paterson.
I do not take a lunch break anymore because I never know who's going to drop out of what allegation's going to come.
This week he pulled out as a candidate in November for his own job. The question now is, can he hold on to his own job through the week?
Well, this entire week has been like one of those cartoons where the cartoon character goes off the cliff and then hits every little cliff on the way down. We're on number 10, 12, 14. Every single day there is something that comes out. The New York Post Thursday morning summed it up with a three strikes. The first was the awarding of a gambling contract to a politically connected firm. That's your sort of standard political scandal. The one that's been consuming us for the last 2 weeks has been the allegation that Paterson interfered in a domestic violence case. And then the third strike, and you'll see why we're doing the three strikes, was the Yankees news that came out on Wednesday in New York City, which is that Paterson got some free tickets to a World Series game, said he was going to pay for them, and ended up sending the check, but only after reporters looked into it and the check was backdated.
The backdated check. The smoking gun. All right, this is a weight of not only things that are going to be bothersome to people, but they have a lot of that kind of juice that people pay attention to. They're great on cable television news. They're great in the tabloids. This is the stuff of fatal scandal.
Absolutely. When I was trying to do stories on this casino deal, it was too complicated. And people were like, I don't quite understand the bidding process for New York City racino deals. But when it comes down to a governor who, up to this point, really stood up on domestic violence. In fact, he helped pass the law that said that you didn't have to be married to bring a domestic violence case. That same law is what is getting him in trouble now, because there was a woman who brought said case against her boyfriend, who is a very close personal aide of the governor. And then there are allegations that the state police met with her, perhaps tried to coerce her into not bringing this case against the governor's aide. And this is the kind of thing people completely understand. This is a woman who is trying to bring a harassment case against a high-placed political official and is getting pressured by the police and perhaps by the governor himself.
So the fallout of all this has already been substantial. We know that Paterson will not be a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the governorship. That clears the field for Andrew Cuomo. We all assume he will fill that cleared field. That makes this fall a lot less attractive to a Republican candidate in the New York governorship race. All of that accomplished in just a few days, and yet eclipsed by the prospect that we'll have a different governor in Albany in a matter of hours or days. Who would that governor be?
That would be Lieutenant Governor Richard Ravitch. Richard Ravitch was the man who helped bail New York City out of its financial crisis in the 70s, a political insider, a negotiator, a smart man, a man who has sort of taken up some of the responsibility for the New York State budget as lieutenant governor. And nobody knows him. I think it's like 78% of New York residents have no opinion of him.
That'd be a real step up right now for the Democrats in New York, would it not, to have a governor but no one knew anything about?
At this point, I don't think we really expect our leaders in New York State to be either recognizable or elected in any way. There are six statewide officials in New York State. Only two of them were actually elected at this point, Chuck Schumer and Andrew Cuomo for attorney general. We have a senator that a lot of people have no idea what she stands for, Kirsten Gillibrand, who was appointed by David Paterson.
I want to get back to Kirsten Gillibrand in just a moment because her situation probably actually brightened during the course of this very difficult week for Democrats in New York more generally. But I want to get back to that in a moment because first we need to talk about the political downfall, if you will. He hasn't left office, but Charlie Rangel, dean of the New York delegation, defeated Adam Clayton Powell back in 1970 to become the congressman from Harlem. He has just stepped down as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee in Congress. What in the world could have induced him to do that, Robert?
Scandal after scandal after scandal. Of course, the one that actually pushed him to this was the House Ethics Committee finding that he should not have taken some trips to the Caribbean on a corporate dime. I think Rangel says that he didn't know who was paying for it. That was the ostensible reason. But of course, there's an entire list of things that Rangel has been accused of over the last year or two. Not reporting income was one of the big ones. The thing that got New Yorkers really upset was that he had four rent-controlled apartments in New York City. You're only supposed to have one. And, you know, you said it before about Patterson. It's those things you can grab onto that make people upset.
That people resent.
Charlie Rangel, of course, from Harlem, as David Patterson is. And Rangel still has immense power and support in his district, obviously, in Harlem.
But right now, he's problematic for his party in Washington. Another symbol of the Democratic leadership, highly problematic at a moment when he has to step away because of these scandals. He says, of course, he'll come back and reclaim the gavel at some juncture, but I don't think anyone really outside of his operation expects that to happen.
Well, you know, when Charlie Rangel stepped down from the chairmanship, he said, I don't want to give basically Republicans fuel to run against Democrats in the fall. That was his ostensible reason. Was he really a factor in races? Is this something you would hear on the stump in Texas or Oklahoma, that Charlie Rangel?
I don't think that they have known his name. I don't think that it has been a household name on the national level. Certainly he is in New York. But still, Charlie Rangel becomes a symbol that when the Democrats get into power, they use it for personal enrichment. Whether it's fair to characterize an entire party on the basis of one man or not doesn't matter in politics and campaigns. He makes a symbol, and I suspect he was going to be and is going to be more famous as a former chairman.
Yes.
Of Ways and Means, in a political sense, in this fall's campaign, than he ever was when he had the job.
Well, remember, what we've learned in politics now is you never have to single out one person. You just make an amalgam. I'm sure it'll be the Pelosi-Rangel-Reed Congress that you run against, right? You just shove them all together into one big, unattractive mess, and that's easy to run against.
Let's say Charlie Rangel gets reelected in November. I assume he's going to want to be reelected, and will he be in any trouble this November?
Well, if he wants to run, he's not in any trouble at all. But there are suspicions, I will say, that if he does not have the chairmanship, that he may not want to be a backbencher. And already the political elite of Harlem are saying, yes, of course, if the seat opens up, I wouldn't want to run, including, you mentioned, Adam Clayton Powell, the third, who Charlie took the seat away from 40 years ago. Well, his son, Adam Clayton Powell, the fourth, an assemblyman here in New York State, would probably step forward should Rangel decide not to run.
You know, moving across the state to the western part of the state, there is a Democrat who won't be on the ballot this fall, and that's Eric Massa.
He decided for health reasons, he said, that after, what are we at, a year, year and a half in Congress, he would not run again. He was already one of the more endangered Democrats, certainly in New York State and probably
I think that's
the
one
country.
Of the most Republican districts in the state. Is it not? Randy Kuhl had it before.
Absolutely. And he only won it by a couple of points in a big Democratic year. Everyone assumed, of course, he was going to run again. He had raised a lot of money for the race. There have subsequently been stories and allegations that
there have been allegations of troubles with his relationships with some of the people on his staff. And we'll see how that plays out in the days ahead. He has certainly said that it's strictly a health matter that's causing him to step down. But there may be more news on that front.
And the one thing he did say on the record about any sort of allegations about him and staff was that he often used, I love this, salty language. He goes 100 miles an hour and uses salty language.
Well, that would certainly be a disqualification for someone serving in Congress. One disqualification that really does work for being in Congress is refusal to run. In the state of New York, Robert, you have also had a couple of very high-profile non-candidates for the United States Senate, people who some folks at least said were certainly going to run. Now, apparently, they are not.
What? Haven't you seen the fashion pages? This is the latest thing for the elite in New York City. What do you do when you have everything? You have a beautiful apartment, you have a driver, you have everything. What you decide to do is you decide not to run for Senate, because that's really a lot of work. You decide to explore the options. This has happened for the last 4 or 5 months. People exploring the options of challenging our appointed senator, Kirsten Gillibrand, who's appointed to Hillary Clinton's seat. And we'll set aside all the people who said they would consider a run. The latest two to say that they were considering and then drop out were Harold Ford, former Tennessee congressman who ran for Senate there and lost, and Mort Zuckerman, the publisher of the Daily News. This was fascinating because this showed you the two different ways you can do this game of exploring for the Senate. Mort Zuckerman, he did it the traditional way. You leak to the New York Times that you are considering it. There's a flurry of stories. You run it up the flagpole. You take phone calls with all the political elite. You see how much money you can raise. In his case, he's a billionaire. He doesn't need it. And you look at the polls. Maybe you send a poll out in the field, that kind of thing. He took about a week and said, nah, I don't want to do it. Harold Ford shows the other way you can do this, a long, long, painful way. Harold Ford does the same thing. He floats this idea that he's thinking about it, but then he doesn't shut up. He just talks and talks and talks, and the more he talks, the more people are like, who is this guy? He's only been in New York a year. He says he's only visited Staten Island by helicopter, which is not what you want to hear when you live in Staten Island.
What, he hasn't heard of the ferry?
And then he decides he's going to do a listening tour, just like Hillary did. And once again, he hasn't announced he's going to run for Senate, but he's doing a listening tour anyway, a listening tour where I went with him to Syracuse. He appears to not listen whatsoever. He just talks and talks and talks and talks and talks and talks. And it was one of those things where you're just like, he just likes this. He likes the attention. He likes the press. But the numbers were not on his side. At the end of the day, he just didn't have it. She had locked up the money, the Wall Street money. She had locked up the endorsements. He had no numerical chance, really.
Given his proclivities, I would expect his next career move would be into podcasting.
Well, you know, you noticed that he dropped out of the race, and I think about 7 hours later, he was on MSNBC again as a regular commentator. I mean, that's
there
what
you
he
go.
Loves.
Well, he got a better offer. Well, look, Kirsten Gillibrand may not be the juggernaut of New York politics or anybody else's, but it appears at this point that she is going to be made to look pretty invulnerable by the number of people who have talked about running against her and then in the end wound up not running. Let's just say for the moment, Gillibrand is the default nominee of the Democratic Party for the Senate this fall, and we're still waiting to see who her Republican opponent will be as well.
Very fair to say. And I have to say, to her credit, she was willing to go bare knuckles with Harold Ford and did a pretty good job of making it unpleasant for him to even consider running against her.
Now, if we can move away from New York just for a moment.
But what? Should I go get a Coke or something?
Down here in Washington, we have had this little debate going on about health care, the biggest bill pending before the Congress. The president at midweek made what some people were calling his final offer, gave a speech about how he had tried to meld the House and Senate bills, tried to bring together Democratic ideas and Republican ideas, the best ideas of both. Of course, about 98% of the bill was the Democrats' ideas. And as one Republican leader said, you can't just put sprinkles of Republican ideas on top of a 2,700-page bill. But in essence, that's where bipartisanship stands in Washington today. And we are going to try to move the bill through both the House and the Senate using a simple majority vote in the House and a simple majority vote in the Senate through a procedure.
A mere majority?
Imagine the majority would rule in the Senate in this case by using a budget procedure called reconciliation. Now, it's been interesting to watch the Republican Party react to this by trying to portray it as a usurpation of power unprecedented in the history of the Republic. That's very important because procedurally they're trying to show this is the spirit of government takeover, the same sort of government takeover that they say the health care plan itself will constitute.
Yeah, it's almost as if the Republicans had never heard of this concept of reconciliation before
now,
this year.
Okay, now, all right, some of us are a little older than you, Robert, and we remember 1981 when the famous tax cuts of Ronald Reagan were accomplished as part of the reconciliation in that year's budget year. Also the spending cuts and many other things since then, something like two-thirds of the years, Congress has found something that they wanted to accomplish in reconciliation that was of some substance, but never something that constituted a reordering of so much of the overall economy.
Whenever they talk about these Senate rules, my eyes start to glaze over. But my question to you would be, even though at this point the Democrats want to be able to use these rules and can complain about filibusters and want to use reconciliation, do they have any incentive to get rid of some of these protections for the minority? I mean, especially after recent events, they may worry about being in the minority once again.
That's always a consideration. And both parties, especially in the Senate, where we haven't had these very long, decades-long dominations by one party or the other, the individual senators prefer a world in which individual senators have ultimate power, where they can threaten to filibuster, and by threatening to filibuster, perhaps hold up the Senate for days. And we saw a demonstration of this just this past week, where Jim Bunning, the irascible senator who is leaving in November and was kind of eased out by the majority leader, who happens to be his Republican colleague from Kentucky.
I hear he doesn't need salty language because he has a middle finger. That's what they say around here.
Well, Jim Bunning was a Hall of Fame pitcher back in the prime of his career was in the 1960s. He played 17 years, and he was known as a tough competitor. Well, he is still a tough competitor who plays the game, as many pitchers do, with pretty much just one player in mind. So Jim Bunning went out on the floor of the Senate one night and decided to stop a bill extending unemployment benefits, a bill that virtually every senator wanted to vote for. But he said, we ought to pay for it. We ought to take money out of something like, oh, let's say the stimulus bill from last year, and essentially asserted his right and privilege as one senator to reorder the priorities of the entire body in the federal government and take money out of one program and put it in another, and said that if they weren't willing to do that, he was just going to hold up the bill forever.
Yeah, that's what they call little chin music down there, right?
Well, and Jim Bunning was not above using those tactics when he was a pitcher. But in this particular instance, what did him in was that his own Republican colleagues did not want to make that kind of a stand on that sort of a bill. They are perfectly willing to try to get the federal government to live more within its means. That's been part of the Republican platform for generations. But they didn't want to have the fight on this bill. Bunning was operating as a lone wolf. He was pretty much calling his own play. So the party deserted him, left him out there to dry, and after several days of the Democrats forcing him to actually hold the floor to some degree, although he wasn't giving long extended speeches like this one, he was forced to get out there and inconvenience himself by at least holding the floor in a procedural sense. So eventually he let the bill go through, but he did draw attention to just how strange these Senate rules of personal individual empowerment can be.
Well, do you think it had any effect on the bigger issue, at least stretching the idea of pay-as-you-go? I mean, I know more and more Democrats are feeling that they have to take stands for that. I mean, I know that there was a debate of the jobs bill in the House, which should have been an easy thing to pass, but there were, in fact, people who had the same sort of rhetoric as Jim.
Yes, and I think that he has made the point, certainly among conservatives, some at least consider him a hero for doing this, and that there will be many other cases of people being less disruptive, but making much the same point and wanting to see more and more bills explicitly paid for. And that will mean spending cuts, of course, because even in this Congress, with these Democratic majorities, tax increases are verboten.
So being involved in New York politics and just being overwhelmed with these people who are in the race and out of the race, they're running, they have to drop out, scandal. I was impressed that any state could actually have two candidates seemingly without scandal run against each other and still be terribly, terribly exciting, the Texas primary.
That's right. Texas Governor Rick Perry, who not so long ago looked to be in a lot of political trouble and looked to be vulnerable to a challenge from the state's very popular longtime Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, was able to win the primary with more than 50% of the vote, eliminating any need for a runoff, defeating not only Kay Bailey Hutchison, who faded in her challenge to Rick Perry, but also a Tea Party activist named Deborah Medina, who some people thought was going to be a real threat to the two front runners. She turned out not to be that big a threat, and Rick Perry was able to secure his nomination relatively easily.
Well, I thought it was fascinating because here in New York, of course, we only have one flavor of Republican, which is a billionaire Democrat who doesn't want to run in the Democratic primary. And so this notion that in Texas you could have these factions.
There really are three, at least, Republican parties in Texas, but together they are totally dominating the statewide scene. It's been since the 1990s that the Democrats have had a statewide official in Texas elected. So right now, they can afford to have different flavors of conservatives, including Rick Perry's flavor, Kay Bailey Hutchison's slightly more moderate, more big city-oriented flavor, and then the flavor of Deborah Medina, the Tea Party candidate. I think she was not, in many respects, a legitimate or serious candidate by any normal credential. But in Texas, where there is a tremendous anti-Washington feeling and also a tremendous anti-Austin feeling, there was an audience, didn't turn out to be as large as some thought, for a truly populist rebellion kind of a candidate.
Is that where the line is now? It's okay to call for secession. It's okay to say that states can overrule federal laws. But once you go into 9/11 truth territory, is that the line we have now? That's what's acceptable?
I think that she defined the line over which somebody is considered to be an unproven candidate, but not necessarily completely out of the discussion. That's how far things have moved, at least in some parts of the country. And you were referring there to Rick Perry making an allusion to Texas having some special right because of the way it became a state to leave the union, essentially an assertion of their power to secede. That was thought by some people to be the turning point in his popularity, that he came back from a long decline when he started talking in those terms, and then he was able to characterize Kay Bailey Hutchison as a creature of Washington. And the question is now, as the discussion changes in the aftermath of this primary election, people who had been very much against Kay Bailey Hutchison are now saying, but Kay, we'd like to have you serve longer in Washington. Please don't retire, as you said you were going to do after this primary. Stay and keep that seat, Republican, and we're all for you now.
Oh, come on. She can come to New York. We're going to have a couple openings soon in statewide office, and she can run against Kirsten Gillibrand. We've got so much stuff going on here.
Or possibly she could move to California, where they're always looking for good statewide candidates. And right now, the fashion for Republicans in California appears to be looking for women to be statewide candidates. The Democrats, on the other hand, in California really seem to like experience. They've pretty much already decided on their gubernatorial candidate for this fall, and he just declared his candidacy this week, a name I think you know, Robert.
Jerry Brown. And you know what it is? It's a recycling thing because you have all those stickers from all those other races. And, you know, Californians love the environment. Like, why go and print up a whole new set of bumper stickers when you got the good old Jerry Brown ones? Well, heck, going back to his father, right?
That's right. He's Edmund G. Brown Jr. His father was the governor of California in the 1950s, 1960s. Jerry himself was first elected governor of California in 1974. He served two terms. The rest, of course, is history. And now he's back. He's already the state attorney general. He's running for governor right now. He is the favorite to be the next governor of California.
He was known as Governor Moonbeam, and, you know, the moon always rises again every 28 days, right?
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Robert Smith.
Join us again next week for the triumphant return of Ken Rudin to It's All Politics from NPR.
Can I just have one more moon dance with you, my love? Can I just make some more romance with you, my love?